नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So it's the full moon Upasatha day, and this is the first time I've been here at Amaravati for several weeks, and the first time that I've given the Dhamma talk in the sala. So it's a bit of a new experience in many ways. Just arriving back in community again, having been spending some time away. And I've just spent a week at Chithurst in the forest, and spending a bit of time with the community down there, which has been extremely pleasant. And it's very, very pleasant to come back and be in the community here. And I'm enjoying this sort of more of a sense of intimacy, sort of sitting closer, feeling of more of a sense of connection, perhaps, which is very pleasant. And even with the kind of awkwardness about who's going to give the talk and where they're going to sit, somehow or other that gives more of a feeling of just being part of the human family. And as we all know, families have their difficulties and misunderstandings, and hopefully, if it's a good family, we find a way of not making too much of a problem about it. We just realize that there's going to be awkwardness. Where there are people, there's awkwardness, and that's just how it is. And it's certainly a lot better than what most of humanity's up to. Certainly the impression I have. Most of you may know that I've been, in fact, living away from the monastery for these last months, spending time up in Edinburgh, supporting my father since my mother died in June. And I was saying at Chithurst the other evening, I have a chance to learn a lot about what goes on in the world, because my dad likes to watch the news every day, and we get newspapers which arrive every day. And if you use that as your yardstick for what's going on the planet, in the world of nature and the world of humanity, politics, and so on, it's a pretty depressing picture. Human beings seem to be able to do the most horrible things to each other. And one really gets a very strong sense of the preciousness of situations like this. Just a very, very remarkable situation, very remarkable community of people who are making a sincere endeavor to live carefully, to live in harmony. It's quite extraordinary. So I'm deeply, deeply grateful that places like Amaravati, Chithurst, Harnham, Hartridge, and other places like this exist on this planet. Being away from community, living away from monks and nuns, away from a situation where there are regular pujas, where that's the a very clearly defined monastic form. I found it's been a very useful experience, in fact. It's given me a chance to really ask some questions about what it is that we're doing here. why do we put ourselves through it? Why do we do this? And sort of shaving the head, wearing robes, keeping precepts, following these routines. Just sort of chance to really consider what is the point of it? What is the usefulness of it? Is there a usefulness to it? Is it something that is beneficial? Couldn't we just practice in a more ordinary situation where we don't stand out so much, when we're not quite so peculiar? I mean, living like this in Edinburgh, I'm very peculiar. I walk around and people notice this odd being walking around the streets, travelling on buses. Sometimes you think, well, you know, why do I have to look so different? Why do I have to be so odd? And nobody really quite knows what I am. And then all of the things around food and eating and having to just eat at a particular time. You know, most regular people, they have supper. And they can eat any time. Why this sort of definite thing about just eating in the morning time is really inconvenient. And you know, all the rules about, you know, food being offered in a particular way and so on. It was interesting giving the talk at Chidhurst the other evening, because there they had the Dharma seat kind of in the middle of the hall, halfway down the hall. So sort of in front of me and kind of to this side, there were all the lay people, and they were all sitting a little bit higgledy-piggledy and all wearing sort of regular lay clothes, and they all had hair, things. And they were sort of sitting, you know, quite comfortably listening to the talk. And then I sort of looked up at the other end, and there was the ordained community. And I was a bit shocked, actually, when I looked up and saw these incredibly neat rows of neat people all sitting up very, very straight, all shaven head, robes, and sitting very, very neat in a very sort of definite, strict formation. And in one way, it was quite shocking, a bit forbidding. The this was the nuns here and the monks here, very strict formation. And I've been contemplating this impression, because it was so very striking to me, the contrast. Not with a view to making any kind of judgment about whether one is better than the other, but just more kind of contemplating what it means, really. Um, the lay community and the lay practice and the lay form, and then the very much more clearly defined monastic form. And I was thinking about it in terms of like our internal work, the internal work that lay people need to do in their practice, and the internal work that seems to me to be really important for monks and nuns to be doing. And in some ways it's as though it's kind of like the reverse of the external appearance. This is just my own kind of take on it. Because what was particularly striking about my impression of like the lay community sitting was that they were very comfortable and very alive and very human. And it seems to me that as nuns and monks, although we have a very clearly defined external appearance, a very definite form, definite ways that we do things, and we all look very much the same. But it seems to me that it's really very important that we nurture our humanity, our individuality, our vibrancy, our difference, our specialness. And for me, there's always it's like a kind of paradox that this life, that this form presents us with, where we do have to, you know, it's clear that we have this structure, we have these robes, we have this way of being, we have many rules about how we sit, stand, walk, how we behave, how we conduct ourselves. And I must say, I very much appreciate these things. It makes it, I just find that they help me to be mindful. They help me to contain my, I mean, this might surprise you, but I have a kind of a flamboyant streak, which doesn't often get an airing in a public situation, but it's... certainly those of you, anybody who knew me 20, 30, 40 years ago, sorry, maybe 30, 40 years ago, 20 years ago I was like this, 30, 40 years ago would have a very different impression. And so that's definitely there. But I actually find that behaving as a nun it supports my mindfulness, it supports my quality of presence. It keeps the flamboyant side a little bit in check. But I think there is a danger that if we hold on too tightly to our monastic identity, that can stifle something very precious. I remember reading a book about nuns, many years ago, and one of the comments that one of the people in the book made, this was a book about Christian nuns, that surprised me at the time when I read it, but it said that, you know, to be a nun, you have to have a bit of fire. There has to be that spark, that passion, and it needs to be there. So it's not a kind of extinguishing of the flame. And my sense is that if we live the life in the right way, it makes it burn brighter. But it's like a purification, this way of practice. So the flame, the vitality, the energy is there, but it's we learn to understand our passion, we learn to understand our desire, our longing. And we learn how to direct it in a wholesome direction, a wholesome way. So we can enter into our lives, we can live our lives fully and passionately, but for the welfare of others. I've got a little tiny figure that I have on my shrine that I found when I was going through. I had this friend Patricia who died some years ago, and all going through all the things in her house, and one of them was this little tiny figure of a Japanese lady playing some kind of instrument. And there's something about the posture, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny little thing, but there's something about the figure that gives me a sense of the kind of passion that we need to bring to our religious life, the kind of devotion, wholeheartedness. So when we come into the life and until we're enlightened, obviously these longings, these passions, they go in all kinds of directions. And we can experience enormous amounts of rage, enormous amounts of sexual desire, enormous amounts of greed, enormous amounts of aversion of all kinds. For some of us, our aversion tends to go outwards. For others of us, it tends to go inwards. We hate ourselves. We feel useless. We feel inadequate. We all kinds of negativity that can turn inwards. Or we hate everybody else. It goes outwards. We hate the form. We don't want to. We have a tremendous amount of resistance. We don't want to do things in a particular way. We definitely don't want to conform. We don't want to be just another nun. We don't want to be just another monk. We don't want to, bow or whatever. For each one of us, we'll have a whole list of things that we don't want to do. There'll be particular moments. Maybe sometimes it's fine to do it, but if the wrong person tells us at the wrong time in the wrong way, we definitely don't want to do it. And that can be very strong. That passion. And we can feel that we shouldn't have it. We shouldn't have negativity. We shouldn't have aversion. We shouldn't have strong desires. And we can try to live our religious life. We can try to keep our precepts in a way that just pushes them down. And the effort to be a good nun or a good monk or a good layperson, just pushing it down, behaving ourselves. So our challenge, particularly as monks and nuns, is to understand these energies. Certainly to contain them, because if we follow every impulse, and just let it flow out in all directions, we can cause a lot of disruption in community, a lot of confusion, a lot of unhappiness. But we do need to understand them, we do need to acknowledge them, we do need to allow them into consciousness. My sense is that we have to make the heart very, very big. Just really expand the heart. We talk about the Brahma-viharas and the boundless sense of kindness, boundless sense of compassion, of joyfulness, of equanimity. And we tend to think of these as... that we externalize them, and certainly that's something that we do. They are a kind of outward emanation. But I would suggest we also consider ways of just making the heart very large to contain our own humanity. To encompass our passions, our longings, our fears, our desires, to encompass these with a sense of compassion, with a sense of kindness, with a sense of equanimity, a sense of serenity. It's a strange old practice, because what's coming to me now is just a sense of how important it is not to take it all too seriously, not to take ourselves too seriously. I think this is where some of us lose the vitality. We think we have to be perfect. We have to get it right. And it's very difficult for us to get it wrong, or to feel that we've got it wrong. We're very idealistic. Sometimes we can't laugh at ourselves when we're in the middle of some kind of struggle. Sometimes if we've just made a terrible mistake, made a terrible fool of ourselves, we can't always laugh at ourselves at that moment. But perhaps one thing we can do is, after we've had some disaster, some terrible loss of face, perhaps later on in our quieter moments, we can just consider what happened. What was I so afraid of? What was it that was so terrible about what happened? Was it so terrible? And maybe in that way we can begin to get a little bit lighter about it all. So it seems for me, as I said before, that the biggest challenge for the ordained community is to stay in touch with our humanity, to stay in touch with our human failings, our human weaknesses, our human energies and passions and longings and fire, and to really enjoy the life, live it in a way that we can enjoy the life. So we keep the form. We continue to shave our heads every fortnight or whenever we feel like it. We continue to dress neatly, to carry ourselves and conduct ourselves in a composed manner, simply because that's something we do for our own welfare, but also for the welfare of one another, and also because it's a very, very powerful sign in the world. As I said, when I looked over and witnessed the ordained community from the high seat at Chithurst, you know, it was a very, very striking impression. Just a sense of the power of a group of men and women who have a very sincere commitment to waking up, to understanding our humanity, and to liberating the heart from the bondage of our greed, hatred, and delusion. And just really understanding that paradox. Contemplating the particular challenge for the lay community, I was contemplating this and realizing that whereas for the monks and nuns, our internal work is about softening and relaxing in some way, it seems that in a lay situation, it's about actually making one's resolve very clear. And sometimes when people come on retreats, one of the things I always sense at the end of a retreat time is a sense of almost panic at the thought of leaving a very structured situation, a situation with a tremendous support for practice, sort of regular sittings and precepts and a monastic form and monastic schedule. And realizing that when people leave a retreat, they're going to go to a much less supportive environment, and just how to manage that. And my sense is that there needs to be quite a strong sense of determination and quite a strong sense of clarity around the refuges and around the precepts, particularly in order to sustain practice. This is not to say that the monks and nuns shouldn't be have a clear sense of the precepts and the refuges. But if there's anything a lot of our practice is about letting go, and Ajahn Chah's encouragement is to keep letting go. But actually we do need to hold on to some things, and what I would suggest we hold on to, all of us, for all we're worth, is to hold on to the refuges Buddha Dhamma Sangha as a refuge, as a secure abiding, as a place of reference, a place of safety. Because nothing else gives any security, gives any safety. That refuge in awareness, present moment awareness. How is it right now? The Buddha, aware of the Dhamma, the Sangha that aspires to live in accordance with truth, with Dhamma. Visiting James, this friend of the Sangha up in Edinburgh, who's in intensive care, and he's hitched up to all kinds of machines. He can't even breathe on his own, so he has a tube that goes into his trachea and air flowing into the lungs. This incredible life support machine that is helping him to keep going, and he's also got a kind of something that he can use to control the pain, the morphine, and he can administer morphine as he needs it, just to keep the pain at a manageable level. And it was interesting just spending some time with him. And he can hardly speak, because in order to speak you have to have air going over the vocal cords, and because of the way that the tracheotomy works, there isn't actually supposed to be any air going over, but it leaked a little bit, so he could get a little bit of air through, so he could speak a little bit. And I was talking to him about my own experience of being very ill, and a sense of not being sure whether I was going to survive, and whether I was going to make it, and then in my situation I did make it, and just acknowledging for him the sense that maybe he'll make it, maybe he won't make it, but the refuge in awareness. And and he was saying how he's got all these kind of medicines and machinery and things around him, but how he needs other medicine, he needs Dhamma medicine, and how precious that is. Because that's the thing that will sustain us to the end. You can't rely on the body, you can't rely on the people that you love. They're not going to be there forever. It's quite weird for me with my mum having died, because I can't quite believe that she's died. It doesn't seem right. It's a feeling of, she can't have died. It's a feeling of these things don't happen. She was alive, she was always there. And sort of staying in the forest at Chithurst, I was just realizing how much my, like, whenever I've been in the monastery in Chithurst, whenever I was there, she was always there, she and my dad. And, I would phone them up from time to time, and, sort of during the day, I sort of noticed things that that struck me, that were interesting to me, that I thought would be interesting to them, and realizing how much of my life I would just sort of automatically share with them. And with my mum, and just realizing she's not there. And when she first died, we had the funeral, and I just sort of kept thinking, well, this is all a mistake, she hasn't really died. And just doing all these things, going through all the motions, but it's all a big mistake. And it's almost as though the mind has difficulty in acknowledging that people die. You know, particularly somebody who's, you know, very, very close to us, who we've loved very, very dearly for many, many years. You know, and even although, you know, when she died, actually she was very old. She was 87 and very, very frail. I mean, she was so frail, hardly any, just skin and bones. And you know, just really, you know, she was ready to go. But really, a sort of there's a sort of just something kind of quite instinctual that doesn't want to let somebody go. I suppose you call it attachment, really. That we're attached to each other. But in due course, you know, each one of us is going to die. We tend to think of attachment as being wrong. You know, I often hear people saying, well, of course, I shouldn't be attached. And feeling that they've got to get rid of all their attachments. But I think if we try to do that, we actually destroy a little bit of our humanity. Maybe I'm being totally, what's the word? Blasphemous. Maybe I'm saying something really wrong. But this is just my own reflection. And I don't think the Buddha said it, but this is my own reflection, so you can blame me if I got it wrong. But it seems to me that we can't just get rid of attachment just because the Buddha said we shouldn't be attached. My sense is that actually what the Buddha was saying was not that we shouldn't be attached, but that if we're attached, we're going to suffer. So the way that I see it is that when we love somebody, when we're attached to somebody, that there is a little bit of a price tag there. That when the time of separation comes, there is going to be sorrow. So it's not that we shouldn't be attached, that we mustn't be attached, but we must be willing to pay the price, to experience the sorrow. When we're fully enlightened, we'll know fully and completely that attachment brings sorrow, and so we'll learn how not to attach. We'll learn how to enjoy one another, but without attachment. That will have got into our bone marrow. But for those of us who are not enlightened, there is attachment and there is sorrow when we lose somebody dear to us. That's normal. So in some sense, all of us need to understand our attachments, acknowledge our attachments, and as far as possible to relinquish them, because we have big attachments to people that we love very dearly. We also have attachments to rather smaller things, things that we can do well to let go of. Our views and opinions, our ideas about this and that, our resistance, our stubbornness. These are all things that we can do with letting go, go of. Letting go through understanding, through acknowledging. Occasionally there are attachments we can let go of even without understanding. We can just see that this is harmful. Don't go near it, let go. But not to let go of Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Not to let go of our aspiration to liberation. Not to let go of our faith, of our confidence that this is something that each one of us can do. In the monastery here, we have all the encouragement that we could possibly have to keep reminding us, to keep encouraging us, to keep going. For those of you who don't live in the monastery all the time, this is something you do need to cling on to, that confidence, that aspiration. Surround yourself with things to remind you that yes, yes, I can do it. Yes, there are people who've given up their whole lives in the pursuit of liberation. So it must be something that's doable, otherwise why would they bother? So to hold fast to these things, to hold fast of the structures that support us in our journey to liberation, to hold fast to the precepts, really use them, you know, keep them with you, keep them close, like the word that we have for our nun form, siladhara, means one who holds, who cherishes precepts, morality, ethical guidelines. You know, even if sometimes there are situations where we find that we're not keeping them absolutely, completely and utterly, totally perfectly, you know, if something happens where we have to do something that's not quite in accordance with the training, yet we keep the training close to the heart. Something to cherish, something to guide us, something to help us. So really, really making friends with the precepts. It's not just like an empty formula that we kind of recite on the Upasita day or when we come to the monastery. You know, that we just take the precepts just so we can feel we've done it. But something we keep close to us and we try to get to know, to become thoroughly familiar with what this really means. Not in a way to make us feel guilty or constrained or bound into something that's harmful or stifling or it's going to spoil all our fun. But something to really to use with interest, with curiosity, creativity. Sometimes people say, well, where's the creativity in the life? And the whole lifestyle is inviting us to be creative. You know, just sort of see how it works. What does it mean for this human being, for this situation? You know, when I'm in this situation, what does this precept, how do I apply it? You know, what is harmlessness? You know, what is right speech? You know, sometimes we think that right speech is just not telling a lie, and I mean certainly we shouldn't tell lies, but you know, sometimes we come out with things that are really unhelpful. And just, you know, to consider, you know, could I have actually done that a little bit better? You know, could I have actually spoken in a way that was more constructive, more supportive, more encouraging, more useful? This is something that I need to consider. Actually, I expect we all need to consider it, but I'm interested in it in my own practice. And just to consider the effect of how I am, you know, particularly in community. So These are just some reflections. I'm very pleased to be having a week or two here at Amrawati, back in community, chance to get into the nitty-gritty of community life. And I'm enjoying my time up in Scotland, just so it is. I'm finding it very, very interesting in terms of my practice. It's interesting just to consider how to live as a nun in a situation where I'm not living with other nuns and not living in a monastery. And just considering, what the practice is in that situation. And you probably won't find it's a huge surprise if I tell you that it's exactly the same as the practice in this situation. Just to be mindful. And just that the conditions are slightly different. And I was saying at Chithurst how some of the lay people, they say to me, well, you know, you must be missing the tranquility of and the simplicity of monastic life. And I just laugh and I say, actually, my life here is much simpler than living in the monastery, much less complex. But it's early days. Maybe I'll find a few ways to complicate my life in Edinburgh. And maybe I'll find a few ways to simplify my life at Amrawati. Anyway, I offer this for your contemplation this evening with my very, very best wishes, heartfelt wishes for your peace and liberation and happiness.